stay where you are, is 18-1068, McLean v. DHS. Mr. Geyer.
Your Honor, it took 9 years for Mr. McLean to
get... You're going to start with the 9 years again? That was the opening line of the last argument.
I'm going to start with this. We know you... let me just see. There were so many issues below, it was hard to read the papers. But what I understand we're here on appeal about is that your client got 9 years worth of back pay, but he's seeking $104,000 for certain medical expenses, and he's seeking a retroactive promotion so that whatever he got after 9 years of back pay would be up by the promotion. Are those the two issues we're reviewing here?
Yes.
Okay. What's troubling to me and really unusual is it seems like your view is that with respect to consequential damages, your client just has to come in and said, over these 9 years, I spent $104,000 on medical issues relating to my discharge. End of story. And the government wants receipts. I mean, any medical claim you put in, anything you claim for insurance, you have to show your receipt. Are they asking for anything more than that? Or maybe information from the doctor about the purpose of those expenses so that they can assess whether they were related? What is unreasonable or unusual about the government's position?
Well, there's nothing unreasonable about the government wanting receipts, and the government does not dispute that. In fact, Mr. McLean gave the receipts to the government as part of the complaint. All of those were sent.
The problem is they weren't put in evidence, right? So, you know,
right.
If I get into an argument with my neighbor and I give him a receipt, but then we end up in court and neither he nor I produce the receipt as part of the proceeding, there's no evidence. And that's your problem here. Your problem is, yeah, Mr. McLean only produced an email that showed there was an attachment, which presumably is a receipt, but that's not the receipt for the court to look at. You may have given them to the government, but you didn't enter them into evidence, and the government didn't enter them into evidence. So what did the MSPB do wrong when it said it's your obligation to prove your damages? And you didn't give us any receipts at all of any kind for a single one of the medical expenses.
Because the statute doesn't require receipts.
The statute doesn't, but common sense does. I mean, you don't think it's fair when someone is alleging an entitlement to damages to make them put in evidence that they actually had those damages?
I think if it's a disputed issue, but it wasn't a disputed issue. That wasn't the government's position.
Are you suggesting he doesn't have to make any kind of a showing that a person, I'm not suggesting your client, but some person come in and said, I spent $500,000 on medical bills, and that's all he has to show? What is the burden shift to the other side to have to show that he didn't? How can that possibly be?
Well, he submitted declarations in which he specifically listed out exactly what he spent, where, and when.
Wouldn't he have provided the receipts?
It's not in the record, Your Honor. It's not in the record as to why that did not happen.
Well, he didn't come in and say, I can't get them, I don't have access to them, it would be too cumbersome for me to try to do this. None of that, right?
That's correct.
Knew the receipts were needed. Required, or at least that some people thought they were required,
correct.
The administrative judge.
Correct.
I reviewed the decision below for an abuse of discretion. So in order for you to prevail on this issue, I have to conclude that the MSPB abused its discretion when it said that you had not proven entitlement to those damages. Is that right?
Yes.
So how is it they abused their discretion in the absence of any corroboration of medical expenses of any kind?
Because Mr. McLean put in detailed sworn evidence as to what he had spent on each of these. It's an extensive set of declarations.
So do you think their error is one of law or fact?
One of law. I don't think that an administrative law judge, when the government is not contesting the expenditures, can just say, well, I simply won't accept the evidence that you've put in, even though it's cognizable cogent evidence just because the receipts are missing.
What do you mean by the government is not contesting the expenditure?
What the government had done was to basically say that none of these are reimbursable. That he made an election with respect to insurance and chose that he wasn't going to have the insurance cover these. That the administrative law judge disagreed, correctly disagreed, and said, no, government, you're wrong. But because the government had relied on that, the government had not put into the record with the judge specific disputes or challenges or claims against what Mr. McLean's declarations had said.
Did the government say the declarations are not enough? He needs documentary evidence, and in the absence of that, you must deny that?
I don't think so.
Really? Because on page red brief, page 23 to 24, it seems to me the government is arguing that Mr. McLean's proof consisted of his own self-serving statements even after the AJ informed him he has to submit proof of his pecuniary damages.
In this court. I understood the judge's the question to have been whether in front of the administrative law judge the government had made that argument. I agree that the government would have to make the
argument if the AJ had already informed him that his own self-serving statement, which is the language the AJ used, wouldn't suffice. He had to actually submit proof. Why would the government have to say, yeah, double down on that? You know, I mean, the AJ had already made a statement of what the standard of proof would be. Why would the government need to come in behind that and say, we agree?
Because the government already had all the receipts.
But they weren't. Again, this goes back to whether I hand my neighbor a receipt or it's entered into a court case. You know, it's...
You would expect the government to say, no, we don't have any such receipts. We never received any such receipts. That's not what the government was in a position of. There, you have a compliance order of basically saying is demurring that we have the receipts, but we're not going to pay. And because Mr. McLean did not present the receipts with those declarations, that therefore it can all just be disregarded.
And I just want to be clear about one thing. Just because the lower court says you didn't meet your burden of proof doesn't mean that they found Mr. McLean incredible or not credible. You know, they just said it's not enough for somebody to just assert this themselves. They have to introduce the underlying proof to substantiate it. I just want to say, since your client is here, I want him to know that none of this dialogue, nor do I understand the lower court to have found that he was not credible with regard to his claims. It's just that in a court of law, there are certain issues for which there has to be certain kinds of proof.
Yes.
Yeah, that was a statement, not a question.
Maybe I missed something. In the AJ's decision, she says, to the extent the appellant may have been confused about the required documentation, he failed to submit further evidence of his expenses despite the November 30th, 2016 order requiring him to do so. So the AJ actually ordered him to provide the information, and he did not comply with the order?
He was told to provide what information that he had. He presented the declarations and the listings and the proof that he had provided this already to the government. And the record does not indicate why the actual receipts themselves were not presented.
Okay, why don't we move on to what you described as your second issue, which is whether or not he was entitled to retroactive promotion.
Yes, Your Honor. And that's what we actually view as the primary issue. That was the main thing that I wanted to be able to
Is this a legal fight you have or a factual fight? Because is it on the legal standard that's applied in terms of what the burden is on promotions? Or
it's strictly a legal standard, although obviously there has to be facts involved. The primary facts involved are that this
Let me ask you about the legal question. Right. Is the legal question that the state of the law, I think now, and our friend can correct me, is that a lot of promotions in the federal government are automatic. Step increases and that sort of thing. If you're a GS-11, you move up automatically year to year to a GS-14.
This was not that case. So our court has said, has it not, that yes, if it were an automatic promotion that was non-competitive, then person under the Back Pay Act gets that retroactive promotion. But in times when it's competitive, it's not automatic that he would get the promotion, right?
Correct.
And then it becomes a question of fact or circumstances, right? And in this case, the government put on a lot of evidence. It was numerical. It was statistical. Only 11% of people got it this circumstance. Only 50, I mean, it was kind of that the large number of people did not get a promotion that were similarly situated to your client. So what is your argument to us? Is it that our legal standard is wrong, or is that the facts were wrong?
The legal standard that has been evolved in non-whistleblower cases has been applied here in this whistleblower case. Our view on this is that tracks Judge Newman's dissent in, and this is in the brief, in Carson versus Department of Energy in the Federal Circuit in 2000.
Well, if you're relying on a dissent in a case as your legal support, then we're probably in en banc territory as we were in the previous case, right?
I think that we probably are. That's certainly the way that I look at this.
Would you have our standard be that it's automatic for whistleblowers to get promotions, even though those promotions for that individual in that position is competitive?
I would have the standard be that the burden of proof is on the government to show that so long as the whistleblower is able to meet a burden going forward, that some number of people in his situation were in fact promoted. In this case, as you pointed out, 12% went from the I band to the J band. 41.7%, and this, by the way, is a typo, and I've notified counsel, but this is obvious, it's a typo. 41.7% of the air marshals did in fact receive promotions. 31% of the marshals received more than one promotion.
So tell me again what your standard would be. If any of them did, if a substantial portion of them did, what's the legal standard?
The legal standard would be the statute, and the statute only provides for two burdens of proof. One is called preponderance of the evidence, and the other is called clear and convincing evidence.
Well, why would this even under preponderance of evidence? Is it your position that this wouldn't have come out the same way under preponderance of evidence if they could show that well over 50% of the person similarly situated did not get a promotion? Ooh. And people that were in his area, etc., did not get a promotion, or a very small percentage did? Why would that not satisfy preponderance?
For us to satisfy the preponderance, I think that it's the same as any other kind of a promotion case, is the employee who's been the victim of retaliation or a prohibited personnel practice has the burden of pointing out that there were at least some other non-whistleblowers who received.
Oh, you're saying that his burden should not be clear and convincing evidence?
No, I think he's saying he shouldn't have the burden at all. The burden should be on the government to disprove.
He should have the burden of going forward, of showing that the retaliation was a contributing factor. We should be tracking the whistleblower statute. Instead, what's happened with the court is the court is tracking Vietnam era court of claims case. That's Power versus U.S. It's all through both of the briefs, and then this court's Bessie versus Department of Air Force in 1986, and Nakel versus Department of Transportation in 1988, both track with that, but they're not whistleblower cases, so they're not affected by the whistleblower statute or the whistleblower policy, which, by the way, is of course what Judge Newman was trying to point out, is that you have to look at what the statute at stake is. The statute is a whistleblower protection statute.
The statute doesn't speak to this issue, does it?
The statute speaks to a burden of proof in which if the whistleblower shows that the adverse action was that animus was a contributing factor. That's all he has to show. It's an extremely low burden. Then the burden shifts to the government to show that adverse action, in fact, would have been taken by clear and convincing
evidence. Yeah, that's a standard you won your case at the Supreme Court on.
Right.
Well, that was correctly applied in this case, was it not?
It was correctly applied at that level. But, of course, that was, as you know, that was a remand. So what the Power case from 1979, that introduced this, what essentially the ALJ decided, which is this clearly established entitlement, to the promotion. And that came out of an OPM rate. If you go back and read Powers, I mean, that's where it comes from. It doesn't come out of the whistleblower law. It doesn't come out of a whistleblower protection statute. This is an old phrase that came as a legal requirement. So you have to show an executive order. You have to show a regulation. You have to show a statute that clearly establishes that legal entitlement. And then that morphed over by some earlier cases from this court, in which it became a factual standard without any discussion over the fact. So what our argument here is that we need to track the statute, and what we have here is an administrative law judge who didn't in any way consider any of the evidence that was presented by Mr. McLean, that he applied for these positions and his declarations he would have gotten, that he was rejected from this position, that these other employees got those. The ALJ just said, I'm not going to deal with any of that because we have this clearly established standard that comes from the Vietnam, literally from the Vietnam War. Thank you.
We'll restore 2 minutes of rebuttal. Let's hear from the government. Okay, now you actually get to speak.
Thank you. Unless Your Honors have a preference, I'll start with the conflict with damages where Mr. McLean's attorney started. This conflict with damages issue is really about the ability of an administrative judge to control his or her docket and to expect that a litigant will provide evidence when instructed to do so. The administrative judge issued an order on November 30th, 2016, telling Mr. McLean to provide objective documentation.
Do we have that order in the record?
It is at 1074, Your Honor. Okay. Or the page where he provides that instruction to the 1074, Your Honor.
And he never responded?
1074.
And he did not respond, or did not respond with the adequate documentation?
Your Honor, he did not provide sufficient documentation. Mr. McLean, over the course of a year, provided a lot of irrelevant submissions, a lot of declarations by Mr. McLean himself, but Mr. McLean was represented by counsel below, and Mr. McLean's counsel should have provided sufficient evidence of consequential damages.
Can I close the loop on one issue that we were discussing before? Am I reading correctly on page 585 of the appendix? This is your March 3rd, 2016, I think, opposition to the petition for enforcement, where you say that appellant failed to submit any evidentiary proof of having incurred the expenses?
The March 23rd response, Mr. McLean's counsel said we didn't contest constitutional damages. Right. That's not an accurate record. That's not accurate, just based on the appendix citation alone that shows that we actually did contest constitutional damages.
6 months or 8 months later, the administrative judge said, I need more documentation.
Yes, Your Honor.
And no further documentation was forthcoming.
He provided, Mr. McLean made a number of submissions to the administrative judge. He did not provide the receipts or the medical evidence that would connect the removal.
Hold on. I just want to understand. Judge Toronto is pointing us to 584, 585, 586, that section. I understood you in these arguments to be contesting whether or not the medical costs were reasonable and foreseeable, namely whether they are linked to whether the various medical and dental expenses are linked to the agency's decision to remove him. I guess I didn't. And did you also argue, and if so, precisely where, that he hasn't even proven the existence of these medical expenses, which I think is the colloquy we were having? Because you said counsel's argument wasn't correct, that we didn't dispute. What he says you didn't dispute is that he incurred $104,000 of medical expenses. In fact, he gave the agencies all the documents. Did you, in this document or any other, dispute whether he had established $104,000 of medical expenses? I understand you to have disputed whether he proved that they were reasonable, whether he proved that they were foreseeable in light of the whistleblower action, but I don't see precisely where you argued they weren't incurred.
I'll point Your Honor to page 585.
Okay.
Second full paragraph down. Appellant failed to submit any evidence or proof of having incurred the expenses or that the agency's removal action caused the injury in the first instance. So we didn't concede below that he incurred over $100,000.
The sentence before that is, he failed to submit any evidence supporting the finding they were attributable to the agency's removal action, but that you're right. The next sentence seems to be...
In the first half seems to be this point.
Right.
To the second half.
Yeah, well, in a single sentence. That seems to be the only sentence, because then the very next sentence jumps back to the first half again. So that sentence seems like a little island amidst an argument about reasonable and foreseeable throughout. But I see the sentence, and I see the footnote that says he... Appellant provided the agency a receipt from a dental office visit prior to his removal. It fails to explain how that could be related. I don't know.
Your Honor,
I see the sentence.
I standing here today, I can't tell you whether I'm sure. Well, I shouldn't say that. We didn't concede that he incurred over $100,000. Whether Mr. McClain incurred, he incurred insurance premiums. We didn't dispute that he incurred.
Well, in fact, I mean, you clearly dispute in footnote 2 one of the expenses he submitted a receipt for, because you say this expense occurred prior to him ever being removed.
So some of the $100,000+ were disputed. I don't know that we dispute. We didn't dispute every cent of the $100,000.
But the AJ clearly on 1074, though, demanded that he submit proof of the pecuniary damages and that proof be objectively documented. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So he was ordered by a court to provide objective documentation, and then he did not follow that order.
He provided a number of filings, but he did not provide, in our view, sufficient evidence of his receipts, for example, or
no,
sufficient.
But did he prove objective documentation? He's objective documentation seems like your own list of I incurred the following expenses doesn't seem to be objective documentation.
That is our view, Your Honor, and he had the opportunity to do so. In this court's decision in Bohawk, which was the 2001 decision regarding consequential damages, it makes clear that this provision of consequential damages is about reimbursement of out-of-pocket costs. So you would expect, and the administrative judge expected, that there would be objective documentation. There would be receipts, or if he was claiming that an expense was related to the removal for medical reason, that there would be medical evidence, like doctor's notes, connecting those. Mr. McClain didn't provide sufficient evidence of consequential damages, and he was represented by counsel below. I know that Mr. McClain has argued that there would be should be some sort of remand for further factual development.
Do you think that this AJ is adopting a rule of law that absent receipts you can never find the establishment of consequential damages?
No, I think the administrative judge laid out the correct standard of what consequential damages are and the burden of proof, and found that there had been a failure to meet that burden. It wasn't. The administrative judge didn't come up with a rule of law that in all future cases.
Okay, then let's, along those lines, that seems like a good segue into the J-band, I-band issue. Do you think the lower court laid out the exactly right standard there when they said reasonable certainty?
Reasonable certainty, Your Honor, was with respect to consequential damages still, not the...
Right. No, you're exactly right. Do you think that's the right standard, reasonable certainty?
Well, reasonable certainty...
seems awfully high.
In the context of the Pastor case, which was the MSPB decision that was cited by the administrative judge, reasonable certainty was with respect to proving medical costs incurred. And in Pastor, the question was whether can you recover for medical costs you actually have not incurred, but you will incur in the future. And Pastor said you can. In doing so, made clear that those damages had to be proved with reasonable certainty. So I don't think that the administrative judge was holding Mr. McClain to some clear and convincing or some higher standard than just the typically in an MSPB proceeding. On the I band to the J band issue, this court has been clear in a long line of cases, going back to CARE and BOES, B-O-E-S-E, and NACL, that the obligation of the agency is to restore the employee to the status quo. And that's what happened here. Mr. McClain was restored to his federal air marshal position in the IBAN. There was no automatic
And he would have received at least 9 years' worth of back pay. And does he also receive interest on the back pay?
Your Honor, I think he received around $800,000 or $900,000. There's some subtraction for money he made in that period. But, yes, right. he received a substantial back pay award, at least $800,000. It included interest.
And so, he did get attorney's fees in the other forums, but not attorney's fees for the attorney work that was performed in this particular case.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So where do we draw the line here? What if the historical data indicated that 50% of the people similarly situated to Mr. McClain had received a promotion in a certain time frame?
Promotion mandated by law, so then you would look at whether some other way he clearly established that he would have been promoted. That 50% would not satisfy.
Wait, does he have to clearly establish it? Is the standard preponderance of evidence or clearly?
Well, this court's decision in those three cases I cited discusses clear establishment. Sometimes I think you see in decisions clear entitlement. The principle behind this standard is that an employee.
But what is clear establishment? Even if 70% of the people similarly situated got a promotion, that wouldn't satisfy that he clearly established that he would have been in that 70 versus that 30%.
Your Honor, it wouldn't. He would have to clearly establish that he would have received a promotion.
And how does one do that? Yeah.
If, for example, in the case of NACL, which is an MSB, the Federal Circuit decision, and in Rickles, there was allegations that promotions were actually routine. It was an up or out type policy.
Okay, but we're in a different universe. We're talking about competitive promotions. And if he could show that all of the other people similarly situated with his identical credentials got 70% of those people got promoted within this 5-year time frame, that's still not enough? Would he have to show that 100%? Would he have to then inspect who got the position and show that he was more qualified than that person?
Newman in the dissent that Mr. McClain's counsel pointed out. That's what we're in en banc territory, as Mr. McClain's counsel conceded with this. It is not the agency's obligation to go through every single promotion opportunity.
But I'm just trying to find out what you think the standard, as applied, clearly established, would require the appellant to do.
I don't think it's necessarily a statistical evidentiary issue every time. You wouldn't go through and look at this. Was just one piece of the evidence.
So is it a sort of like he has to find the promotions and get all the credentials for everybody else, or the person that was selected, and demonstrate that he was more qualified than that person?
That would be if there was a promotion opportunity and there were two other people that applied and he clearly would have received the promotion. I'm not conceding that would
what
definitely
if his credentials were identical to the person that got it?
If they were identical,
that wouldn't be enough under clearly established, right?
If all else were equal, it would be very difficult. I'm not arguing that you can never show clear establishment in a competitive scenario.
Here's what I don't understand. We don't even get to this point until we have an actual whistleblower. We have a government employee that reported a serious risk to public health or danger to the public and was fired as a result of it. Why in the world are we not bending over backwards to help that employee? Why are we setting up, why do we have a standard that requires he prove with reasonable certainty or clearly establish or whatever the language you're using is, why do we have such a high burden for someone who has been injured, who has been definitively found by a court to have been injured in an improper way when they were trying to stand up and save people from public risk or danger? Why in the world would we have that person has to clearly establish entitlement to a promotion in order to say retroactively they would have gotten it? That seems like a high standard given the general circumstances.
Your Honor, Mr. McClain brought an adverse action appeal, a removal challenging his removal. He didn't bring an individual right of action. His affirmative, one of his affirmative defenses was the Whistleblower Protection Act. Under the law in adverse action appeals, what the employee gets upon reinstatement is the status quo, as if the removal hadn't happened.
He gets the status quo. I get that. But Judge Prost is giving you a scenario. What if all 70% of all people in his exact situation would have gotten a promotion? You're saying that might not be enough to meet his clearly establishing that he would have gotten the promotion standard. And I'm saying I think there's a problem with the clearly established thing if that's the case, especially given what we're trying to do here, which is to take someone who was harmed by our government for trying to do the right thing and put them back in the position they would have been in absent that.
A couple of points in response, Your Honor. First, I would reject the notion that Mr. McClain wasn't accommodated upon. He was provided a large sum of money. He was reinstated to his position.
When you say a large sum of money, this is not some windfall to him. This is the exact amount of money he would have gotten if the government had not fired him after he tried to report dangers to the public. And so it's not like he got some windfall. And on top of that, the money is reduced by the guy had to work during those 9 years to feed himself. And so the government takes that money out of what they give him. So there's no concept of windfall whatsoever in this reimbursement, right?
I'm not arguing windfall.
Okay.
Upon his reinstatement, though, he was provided a transfer to a non-flying position, a coveted position. He also was allowed to qualify for promotions outside of the normal course. So I would reject the notion that the TSA did not provide Mr. McClain with the accommodations upon being reinstated. With respect to the showing necessary to show that you are clearly entitled to promotion, I don't think it's just a matter of statistics. I don't that is just one piece of evidence. Mr. McClain failed.
Can I ask you, wholly outside this MSPB context, say in Title VII law or other kind of wrongful firing, when a court finds the firing has been wrongful, you restore the person to the place the person would have occupied but for the wrong, and say it's 9 years until that happens. What standards do courts use in figuring out how many pay raises, what advancement within the office that individual would have had the wrong not been committed in the first place? A clear establishment kind of standard, or just a ordinary but-for standard with all the uncertainties that might go into it?
May I finish?
Please.
Unfortunately, though, I cannot tell you in Title VII cases between private employers and employees, for example, what standard is applied. I do know that in this court, in adverse action appeals at the MSPB, it is the standard that has been laid out in the briefs, and that Mr. McClain seems to concede is the standard, and that's why we're in en banc territory. It is that you have to show a promotion was as a matter of law, or you clearly would have gotten it. I would add, in responding to this last question, that Mr. McClain failed to conduct timely discovery. If he had conducted timely discovery, he would have sought evidence.
Right, but let me just follow up. If we are talking, as you said we were, about a kind of preview of en banc territory, it might really matter how this exact same issue is dealt with in the rest of the world of wrongful firings, wouldn't it?
It may be relevant in other contexts outside of an adverse action appeal at the MSPB. But here we have the law, and it was correctly applied by the administrative judge. Mr. McClain did not seek a timely discovery. He has not challenged the denial of reopening discovery. So we're left to rely on the evidence that was cited by the administrative judge, because Mr. McClain failed to develop his retroactive promotion claim when he should have.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. In discovery, all we were seeking was just trying to get some resumes. Mr. McClain already had pretty well put his case together, and with the volume of submissions to show that why he thought that he would have been promoted. And the issue really is whether or not the administrative law judge can just ignore all of it on the basis of a Bessie and Nagel two decisions, earlier decisions of the court that he cited, neither of which was a whistleblower case, which simply carried forward this 1979 Powers versus U.S. case that had established this clearly established rule. And all that was is quoting, the case specifically says, well, quoting the Office of Personnel Management rule that's there on clearly established, maybe that's the standard. It was non-whistleblower cases that migrated that court of claims forward. And all we are asking the court to do is to get back to, as Judge Newman was saying, and look at the whistleblower statute. That's what governs our burden of proof. That's what governs what Mr. McClain should have had to show. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We thank both sides. The case is submitted. That concludes our proceedings for this morning.